Only if I'm done in 20 minutes, please sort of make up questions, so it's not too embarrassing. This morning is a hard act to follow. There's a lot of really neat stuff there. Some of what I'm going to be presenting is a little bit in the same spirit. What I very much applaud about this morning, all three talks, was how there was focus on events, consideration of other kinds of universes, trying to, I forget who it was precisely, that said we want to get past a state-space view to just actually look at more fundamental things, to try to actually disentangle what just our reasoning process as whatever we are, human beings, conscious entities in the universe, what that then forces us, how that forces us to actually think. Julian, I think tomorrow may also be touching on these kinds of things. So in that spirit, though, with much less profundity, I'm going to drill down on some of the other aspects of what was talked about this morning, things that were not explored, investigated. In particular, there is natural to all physicists, you take as granted the notion that, well, we have some data that we know it is true. The question is, what does it mean to actually know that something is true? This is the basis of epistemology, and there's actually a lot of mathematics that is entrained with that very question that itself has some kinds of implications. It is so natural, for example, in Philip's talk, in addition to, he highlighted very much the importance of things like associativity, but there was this implicit notion that the system is being, the experiment is being repeated many times. How do I know that? Does it require me to be making yet other observations, in which case you'll get a regress, or did I somehow manage to predict it from first principles, that this set of things all constitute the same experiment being repeated? How do I know? So to go after this, what I'm going to start with is some impossibility results that have to do with another aspect of things that hasn't been examined so far, which is the choice of the mathematical language by which we are couching mathematics, computational impossibility results. From that, I'm going to formalize a little bit, just very briefly touch on the notion of knowledge operators, modal logic, and I'll highlight how actually is conventionally constituted. They are not sufficient for our purposes because they actually don't have anything to do with a physical universe. They are unreified, so to speak. What I will then do is say, okay, let's try to make concrete the notion of to know something. I'm going to say that to know something, in essence, means information from outside your head gets to inside your head. I'm not going to say anything about how that happens. I'm going to simply give a definition. How do we even know it has happened? What does it mean to know something? And to try to investigate that, I'm going to look at very stylized Gedanken versions of observation and prediction. Notice that they share certain mathematical properties in common, formalize those as what are called inference devices, and then there are some result properties of inference devices, most of which are actually, certainly at this stage of the analysis, relatively trivial. But nonetheless, I'll explicate them because they might actually constitute a way to get the human mind into the thinking, to risk getting very, very close to Wignerian kinds of conceptions of things. So, okay, there are purely staying within the conventional physics journal literature, so to speak. There are many impossibility results. Chris Moore, I think he was still actually at Cornell, a grad student, when he came up with his, Perel and Richards, where you set up systems who, in classical, well, originally this was done in just some classical scenarios, where there are uncomputable questions about what they will unfold into. So that those results are very sobering, but they raise a very natural question, which is, what if it turns out that the universe is countable or even finite? The uncountability is actually crucial to many of those kind of results. Alternatively, computability is all well and good if all that we have access to are Turing machines. But what if we have oracles? What if, sort of a la Penrose, our brains are oracles? Does that make these kinds of results irrelevant? Or even, to again follow on the spirit of this morning, even if our universe does have the property that there are no oracles and things are uncountable, what about for other universes, for other kinds of systems? Would these results actually then still have any kind of significance? Seth Lloyd, of course, with his book and so on, derives a whole bunch of limitations on what can be computed based upon notions about, like, you can't go fast in the speed of light with information and just viewing the entire universe as a computer. But what if we happen to be wrong about those kinds of laws? Or again, what about in a universe where they were not actually applicable? Gödel's incompleteness theorem. You can apply it to a lot of physical theory. If you first assume that physical laws are quote unquote written in predicate logic, which is actually implicit in almost, well, I would say every physics textbook, one never even considers the issue. If the laws of physics, if God writes in predicate logic, then Gödel's incompleteness theorem would apply, and that provides us with a bit of an impossibility result. The obvious question that this begs, what if the universe is written in some different language, a language perhaps that we've never even thought of, perhaps in some kind of sense could not think of? What if there are no laws at all, just a huge set of events which happen to appear to have patterns, but you don't actually construct them the way that you do in logics? What if Gödel-style intuitionism is correct? We heard yesterday with Lee and Roberto about other kinds of notions about how laws might even change in a somewhat arbitrary nature. Might that cause Gödel's incompleteness theorem not to be relevant? There's actually a nice review paper by John Barrow that goes that investigates some of these issues of whether these impossibility results are actually relevant. It all really begs the question of, well, are we setting up the problem incorrectly? So that then suggests a follow-on question. Is there some model, something akin to our choice of predicate logic, Turing machines, or so on, that's in a certain sense more fundamental, and therefore presumably the impossibility results associated with it are not as far-reaching, but this model, unlike, for example, the choice that the universe is a Turing machine, which many people can quibble with, is there some model of something more fundamental that is really, really hard to quibble with, that somehow just comes from the fact that we are conscious entities trying to do some kind of inference in the physical universe? So I will now argue that there is a more fundamental and therefore less far-ranging kind of such model, which is the notion that we know things. That's what goes into every kind of a theory. I forget who it was precisely this morning said that it was a conditional distribution rather than a joint, because you just start with something that's known, which begs a question. So this is going to be a quick review of what is very often an entire course in math departments or philosophy departments, modal logic, knowledge operators. In particular, I'm thinking of Bob Ohman's formulation of it. This, if people are interested, is how you, I'll get to that part. Let's say we consider a space of events, universes. They could be, for example, world lines. And the intuition is that laws are pattern relating all events on a world line that I happen to know. And the question is, what does it mean to know an event? An event, for example, oops, there's an event for you. Yeah. That's an unfortunate event, instituted by me, some kind of observation. Come on, baby. There we go. So let's say the event is going to be something like it is not raining right now. That is a subset of all possible universes. So in this particular view of things, an event is just some subset of that sense.
If you want to If you're being careful, do you want to be queried on points like why universes is plural and what do you mean by universe?
Oh, a potential. In other words, there's some realm of possibilities. I'm right now actually giving a caricature of the way that modal logic is constituted. I'm giving that kind of reasoning. I'm going to then argue why it is actually insufficient for our purposes. So the way that one would think about here is that there's a bunch of states that reality might be in, one of which it's raining right now, one of which it's not raining right now here at Waterloo and so on. And what it means for an event that it is not raining right now is just a subset of those. It could be, all of those could be just tuples of properties.
So that, I could take that to be a configuration
state. What?
Yes. Of the world,
so. Yeah. Yeah, whatever you would want it to be. So, why are you not now listening to me, little Mac? Oh, this was unfortunate. Why is it not listening to me? There we go. Okay, so we got a Bob. We're in the wrong room, I guess. Perhaps this should be Alice. But before defining knowledge, you first define belief, because beliefs can be wrong. So over there is a universe in which there happens to be a Bob. He exists in that universe, in that configuration, and he happens to believe that an event E actually holds. In this particular case, his belief is incorrect. So belief, in this sense, is not what we mean by to know something, if knowing something means that it's true. At this point, though, if Bob still has the belief of event E, now he actually knows it. It's true. So knowledge is actually a belief function that is a mapping from any particular point in the space to an associated partition, to associated subsets. Knowledge is a belief function where it just so happens that the image of you, the set that Bob thinks he's in, is actually contains the true you. So for example, here is a set of all possible states of Bob's mind in which he knows that he's an E. That's got to be true. And that's actually a subset of the set E. Because we've reduced the event that Bob knows that he's an E to a set like this, just like the original green one, this provides a way for people to reason about what it means for me to know that you know something. Because you can now have somebody else, Alice out here, can now know this blue oval. So this is a way to define what it means for different people to know things. It's the basis of the proof that no two Bayesians can disagree. It's also the basis of the notion of common knowledge, which underlies conventional game theory. I will argue now that it is inadequate. The reason is it has to actually be physically reified, physically manifested. I could right now go through all that little mathematics of knowledge operators of Steve's mind and say Steve right now believes the moon is green, or I could say Steve believes that the moon is gray and therefore Steve actually knows it. I can make up any kinds of things. For this to actually couple to something like physical law, knowledge has to actually be physically manifested in some way. It's got to be a property of a physical system. This is right now just mathematics. It's got to be glued onto reality. And that's not done in conventional modal logic. What that actually means, the way I'm going to address it, is by saying Bob needs to be able to physically answer questions. I'm not going to go so far as to actually say he's got to be able to demonstrate his answers, but there must be something physical in the state of his brain somewhere that constitutes his answer to questions about what he knows. So he's going to be playing 20 questions, so to speak. So what is it going to mean for Bob to be able to physically answer questions about what he knows? To formalize it, I'm going to analyze physical phenomena where Bob knows something. Loosely speaking, to know something, I will say, is to have information from outside my head get inside my head. And those are four canonical examples of what it means to know something. If you observe something and your observation is correct, then you know that thing. If you predict something and your prediction is correct, memory is retrodiction, same thing. If you remember something and your memory is correct, it's not an implanted memory, it's not some fictitious memory. Or another way to actually know something is to control it. I know that Philip is going to have a big bruise on his chin in 1 minute because I'm going to punch him, or some such thing. No, really. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually scrutinize Gedanken experiment versions of observation and prediction to see some, just a very, very small part of the mathematical structure these might all have in common. Yes?
Is there a reason why choosing a theory or having beliefs in theories isn't on the list? Is that a studious omission?
Choosing a theory? There's not knowledge that I'm looking at. It's not knowledge of mathematical facts. It's knowledge of physical facts. Physical theories, if they're in the sense, if they can be formulated in terms of, for example, propositions, A implies B, yes, you can, because those are going to be events. So you wouldn't know it would still be a physical fact in the sense of it's an implication, loosely speaking. That'll be made a little bit clearer later on. So now I'm going to go through observation, very stylized example. Bob says that he's going to be able to observe gamma, the state of the sky, at noon tomorrow, not right now. And for simplicity, we're going to assume that skies come in three possible states, no clouds, some clouds, or completely overcast. And Bob claims that he's going to be able to observe this. I'm not going to investigate how he might come across such knowledge, but I'm going to investigate what does it even mean. semantically, not syntactically, semantically. So, at a minimum, one could say it means many things, but I would argue that at a minimum it means this. I can provide three questions to Bob right now, for example. Is the sky tomorrow no clouds? And he has to answer yes or no. And we'll have to answer yes or no afternoon tomorrow. Was the sky some clouds or was the sky all clouds? And to any of those three questions, he can provide the correct answer. That means he has actually observed the sky state at noon tomorrow correctly. He knows it. The key is going to be that these answers he gives have to match the actual physical truth. So let's try to formalize that. First, at the risk of being a little bit pedantic, what we are going to do is we're going to, getting a little bit back to Lee's question, we're going to strict attention to universes where Bob and the sky exist, and where it just so happens that before noon tomorrow at some particular time, Bob considers one of those three questions. He then observes the answer, whatever that means, and then he gives his honest answer. He's not sort of lying. This is the best of his ability. Then Bob can actually observe the state of the sky tomorrow at a minimum if for each question Q, for each of those three questions, there's some time T1 such that in some universes, Bob can be considering that particular question. So for example, he can be considering the question, does the sky have no clouds tomorrow at time T1? And due to the laws of physics, because the universe is in this state at T1, that implies that the binary answer that Bob gives afterwards actually is the correct answer to the question. So there's got to be some way to configure Bob's head in the past that, combined with the laws of physics, will guarantee that the answer in his head, potentially, or he could write it down or what have you, actually matches up with reality. And that's got to be true for all three questions simultaneously. So a couple of things to note. We've got...
He constrained it. Like, he answered yes to all three.
I'm saying nothing about whether the question he considers maybe even changes the truth. That's how control could come in here. So it could be that he would answer yes to all three if the question that he considers actually then he's a very, very powerful Bob. He gets out and actually changes the state of the sky to make it be correct. So he could, in theory, for different X's now, laws of physics would actually give different states of the sky, and each time his answer would be yes. It's an extremely weak definition of observation knowledge here. You can add much more structure.
How should we understand that double arrow there?
It implies by the laws of physics. It's actually, if you view just the universe as just a set of, just some big set, it's just contained in, logical implication, because that set... contains in its structure the laws of physics. It is not possible. There are no events in which...
It's not physically possible that there are...
Whatever the laws of physics are, nothing is going to be said here about the laws of physics. And that's the sense in which this could be, in the spirit of this morning, any universe. So a couple of things to note. The space U, it's all world lines, universe histories, however you wish to characterize it, that are consistent with the laws of physics, in which Bob and the sky both exist. At T1, Bob considers one of these questions, then makes the observation, then gives an honest answer. The first thing to note is that the state of the sky at noon tomorrow is a single-valued function of U, of the actual universe history we are in. The question Bob is considering, this is where it gets physically manifested rather than just living in abstract math land as knowledge operators. The question in Bob's head has also got to be given by a single value function of the entire world line of the universe. Different function, but it's got to be some kind of physical function of it. Lee?
I'm sure I'm just being stupid. By the question Bob considers as T1, you're saying... At some time before noon, Bob can only ask one of these three questions, and what...
No, I'm not saying that he can only. I'm saying if he were to. I'm saying there's some set of universes in which Bob happens to be considering one of those particular questions, and he's now going to be using an observation apparatus or so on. It could be that he's off doing something else. Notice how I'm actually restricting my space to you. I'm only looking at those world lines in which it just so happens that Bob is considering one of those questions, but I'm not assuming that there are any other ones. I'm just looking at a property within that particular U. So I'm just focusing in on those world lines in which Bob exists, because there are world lines in which there's no Bob. Sky exists. Bob is considering the question. So it's a very, very small subset of all possible. And I'm just looking for some properties within that subset.
And you have behind this metaphysical view in which there are world lines, and those world lines in some sense exist.
Sort of, but to get this more intriguing, I want to say absolutely nothing about any kind of structure on the space U. It could, for example, even be things like statements in a predicate logic, in which case this has to do with, in essence, a model of a mathematician knowing logical truths. So I'm imposing no particular structure. My intuition is being driven by the notion, the notions that you were saying, but that's not going to be required anywhere in this, certainly not explicitly, and I don't think implicitly, though I'm sure that can be, so many things are contested. Okay, so the question he considers is also a function, and the answer he gives is also a function, where you're going to be getting, in essence, the same kind of thing as self-reference, is that all these things are functions of the same underlying world line, and they're going to be restrictions on how they can be related, fairly trivial ones, but nonetheless, they're something. So, observation. Time, noon, T1, T2. There's a set of three possible answers. Those are given by some function gamma of the entire world line U. There's some x that is the question that Bob considers at T1 that's given by another function, and Bob's answer at T2. And basically, we're going to say that by hook or by crook, a necessary, though I wouldn't argue by any means that's sufficient, a necessary condition to say that Bob observes, and in that sense knows, what this has at T2 observed and known, the state of the sky at noon, was that there is some way that you could have set up his mind right now such that this binary answer to the question actually is the same, tells you which of those correctly answers the state, whether it was N, S, or A. So, to write that all out a little bit more pedantically, for any of the three possible questions, Q sub gamma, there exists some X such that if Bob's brain is considering X, that in particular implies that his answer has got to give the correct binary answer Q to the true state of the universe. There is much, much more structure that you might want to add into the definition of knowledge, and it actually gets richer in kind of a analog of the Chomsky hierarchy. It depends upon how far you want to go. This is, so to speak, a DFA, discrete finite automata. It's got none of the other richness one might add, but I would say it's certainly a common characteristic to most things that we would say constitutes observation or knowledge. Nothing in here about the process. It's not the what. It's the what of observation, not the how. Just how do we, what does it mean to say that I know some data? All of these talks this morning were presuming that you somehow know something. What does that statement mean? I'm not even asking how it is that you come about knowing it. Okay, now let's look at a similar way you might come to know something, prediction. Bob gets around. He's got himself a little laptop. He's going to set up to run a program to predict the state of the sky tomorrow. He's not going to observe it now. He's going to run his little program. So we run through the exact same process. He wants to say whether it's no clouds, some clouds, or overcast tomorrow. And this to be a prediction means that the difference between observation is that rather than giving his correct answer after the event, this prediction is going to be correct. In that sense, he knows it. In this case, he's got to do the output before the event occurs. That's what it means to correctly predict something. And if you could do this for the stock market, for example, you would know the stock market tomorrow. That would be really cool. Yes, that should be a subscript. That Q should be a subscript on the X. So we run it through the exact same kind of a thing. The only difference from what we saw with observation was that T2 is now before noon, but we still have these three functions. This one is now different, and actually that one is as well, because it's got the program that he's doing. But nonetheless, you have these three functions that have to bear this exact same relationship to one another. So as far as at least this property is concerned, observation and prediction are actually the same thing. They both share this property. And in fact, I can go through and argue that a memory also shares this property. In memory, in essence, what's happening is I'm just pushing T2 even further back. And control as well. Exactly as Steve was saying, there's nothing in here that prevents the answer yes to all possible questions. Lee.
Yeah, just for, again, I'm just being dumb. Perfect. What sets does X, little u, and so forth take values in?
What sets of X, little
u? What sets? So
nothing's being specified. All of this is completely arbitrary. I'm not saying anything about what this set is of possible X values. I'm not saying anything, well, here, gamma can only be one of the three, but in general...
So gamma can only be one of the three, but Q of gamma is one...
This is a binary function of the state. So for a particular gamma, for in other words, for all clouds tomorrow, this is going to be a 1 if the actual state of the sky tomorrow is all clouds, a 0 otherwise. This gives the state of the sky at noon tomorrow, and this then maps that into a bit.
And why... is also a binary function?
Yes. But X, I'm saying nothing. X is some function of your mind. Let's say this is skating the surface of, Vigneron and so many others. This is something, it could be something that you write down. You could say, here is the question that I'm considering, in which case X would be a function of a pencil and paper. But it could even just be what's in your mind. The point is that it must be some physical thing, whereas modal logic does not have that kind of requirement in it.
And so the claim is that there is a theory of the universe, including Bob, such that X and U refer to states in that theory of the universe, such that X is the prediction that he makes as a function of the state of the universe. Little x is the prediction, capital X is the function.
Little x is the question he poses to himself. Y is the answer he gives to that question. He says, yes, the...
So why doesn't y depend on little x?
Oh, because little x is how you are actually setting up the universe. In other words, this saying that this is true is a restriction on the possible sets u. So this is saying that u must be in one of those states in which he is running a program on his laptop which will correctly end up with this. And that means that by the laws of physics, if you are in one of those states, you've got to be there. For me to run a program and know that's actually going to correctly make a prediction, that means implicitly I'm relying on the laws of physics to somehow couple my program, or how data came into my program, the actual dynamical laws of the atmosphere, and so on. I'm relying that there is some such physical laws that will imply that so long as I set up my computer program initially in the right way, that the answer it gives is going to be correct.
Just one more clarification. Where does time get into the mathematics I see in the picture?
Nada. Nada. That's why it applies just as well to memory as to prediction. It's going any direction. And so, as I said, observation is the same thing, just you have a difference. And exactly as Kevin just emphasized, there is no chronological ordering. More generally, I would say that this is not just observation, prediction, retrodiction or control. In other words, it's know, what it means to know something. However that information concerning the state of the, quote, outside world got to be something that you could answer a yes-no question. For any questions is all we're playing. That's what it means to know. No chronological order, exactly as Kevin emphasized.
At the very beginning you said you in the space of possible worlds, and then you moved to possible universe histories.
That was to motivate my general definition of knowledge. I was going to then say, okay, what does it mean to know in the simple-minded, world-line kind of a universe that we think of? It means that you've got these kinds of relationships. And so I'm going to now say that is my definition, so to speak, of know, and it could be expanded to other spaces as well. You could talk about knowing things over any kind of a set.
So am I right that this applies to physical theories that are deterministic? Because were they stochastic,
it wouldn't
necessarily have a single...
And then if it were stochastic, then you wouldn't be able to predict something correctly. I'd be guaranteed of it. I guess actually there's no probability distribution on this right now. And at the very end, you're leading to a very, 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 very rich territory where the math is frankly so far beyond what I've been able to crack. But so far I've not thrown down any kind of probability distribution across you. When you do, things change. in certain interesting ways. There's more structure that gets involved. So at this point, I am all thinking implicitly, if you're going to map this onto physical reality, though it's deterministic. But you'll see what happens with probabilities. The really cool thing, if it were to be true, would be if you put down probability distributions and talk about knowledge this way, if somehow quantum mechanics came out. But that would be cool, and I'd give a 1% chance of being true.
So somehow an informal description of what you're doing is you're playing on this idea that knowledge is true belief. And
that's physically manifested somehow.
And you're operationalizing both belief as some state of a person's mind, brain, and truth as some process of verifying it. And what you just explained is that when you're careful about formulating that statement in a physical context, knowledge is true belief, the time ordering between the establishment of the belief and the establishment of the truth is irrelevant for the logical relation.
For this very, as I said, there's much more that one could argue should go into a definition of knowledge, of observation, and so on. This is just a very, very small part of it. If you were to add that extra stuff, those extra restrictions, those extra structure, then you might get some kind of a time ordering, depending on how you do it. But with just what I've written up here, there is no time ordering. So this is what this is doing is, there's always an 800-pound gorilla in the room when we're talking about foundations of physics, which is our minds. It's sort of how you not know that you're a brain of that kind of a thing. What would it mean to know anything? How do I know that I'm not a brain of that and the universe ends in 2 seconds? Time's up. How would I? That kind of a question to actually push in a little bit. Modal logic start on that process, and I'm just trying to extend it a little. Okay, so we got to there. So this is sort of a recapitulation here. I'm calling what I'll call some term, and I don't want to call it no, because no has a lot of connotations. An inference device, all that is a pair of functions over space where the second one is binary valued, and I'm going to say it weakly infers some particular function. It knows that function, it observes it, predicts it, whatever. If for any possible value in that function's range, there is some way that you could set up your observation device, give it a question, give it a program, such that if it has been set up that way correctly, then the binary answer it gives to that question is correct. That's what I'll call that weak inference, weakly know something. As I say, there's much more structure one could argue should go in there, and when you actually put it in there, some other fun things come out, but I'm not going to talk about that today. Some interesting things were light of some of yesterday's discussion. This exploits counterfactual questions. You're saying not that in the universe Bob was asking himself something. You're saying, could there have been a universe in which if Bob did ask this binary question of things, it would have logically ensued that the answer he gives is correct. That's somewhat analogous to the use of counterfactuals. I don't know if people are familiar with Bayes' nets and the definitions of causality, Judah Pearl's work, and so on. It's all based upon the notion of you intervene from the outside into the system to try to see how things are causally related. And so some advantages of using these binary questions as opposed to some other ways of doing it. If the range of the functions you're asking about changes, then the formalism doesn't. The actual device, the answer that you pop out doesn't have to be gamma of u. And so on and so forth. This can be viewed also as a way of formalizing semantic information. Shannon information theory is all syntactic. It famously, infamously, has nothing what to do with the actual content. It's a distribution over variables. It says nothing about what those variables, quote unquote, mean.
Dave, sorry, just a clarification. On the last slide, I missed the quantifier on u. It's
three.
Sorry? I don't know what the quantifier on u is or where it belongs.
Oh, u is... X of u for any u, I'm sorry, it should be for any u within capital U such that this condition holds.
Right. Oh, that's where your liability comes from.
Yeah, yeah. So
it's
I'm
not
the,
just true belief, this is like an extremely reliable true belief.
Yes, completely reliable in this case. I'm not a probability.
True belief.
Yeah, yeah, in this case. So Okay, so just a little bit of terminology. I'm going to call x the setup function sometimes. I'm going to try not to do this too much, but it might slip. The conclusion function is y. And then just some notation. I want to say the device, Bob, whatever, who's have a question he can ask, where he can be set up, and then a conclusion. That combination knows gamma, infers it. I'm going to indicate that with right arrow. Okay, one thing to note that I've slipped in here under the rug, sort of, and this is just one slide to more explicitly connect up with the theme of this workshop, is what kind of a picture of the laws of nature this provides us. Or here, calling it, say, a reality. In this case, for any set of people, like those in the room, our reality, our joint reality, so to speak, it's some space U. Then we have the set of the devices, or whatever it is, the 20-odd inference devices in this room, the 20-odd people who can know things, and a set of functions that we might be able to know, that we might be able to infer. So a reality is a quadruple of, actually, it's not a quadruple, it's a triple, whatever. A set of possible events, whatever you want to call it, then a set of possible inference devices, which can, amongst other things, perhaps know things about one another, which is where quantum mechanical kinds of things might arise, and then a set of other kinds of things that they might know. The relationships between these, what the device Steve knows about the conclusion function of the device Philip, who then knows something about a particular question concerning the state of the sky tomorrow, that inference relation is all that there is that can be ascertained by any of the members of the reality. The underlying space U is irrelevant. In other words, in this picture of physics, there are no world lines or anything like that. It's simply a set of relationships between what we can know. I can know that if I control a device set up in a certain way, it will then have the following, and then observe something else. They will be related in this particular way. That's an instance of inference, and the actual underlying set that this relationship works over is not relevant. The laws of nature are patterns in that inference graph. So anyway, now I'm going to just illustrate some, frankly, rather trivial properties of these things, but nonetheless, you do get some impossibility results. Let's see, some bookkeeping kinds of things. Inference need not be transitive. For me to know what Steve is concluding, the value of his bit, and for Steve to be able to know the value of Kevin's bit does not mean that I can directly know Kevin. For any particular question, like the state of the sky tomorrow, you can always design an X and a Y. You can design a consciousness, an inference device, that will know that particular thing. But there's also an impossibility result. If I, rather than start with a function, ask, is there a inference device that can know it? Is there a person that can be conscious of, truly conscious of it? I'm aware of it. I can then instead specify the device. So this device is Steve. And it turns out there is always something, no matter what the cardinalities of the underlying space or anything like that, there's always a function that I can construct, being a devil's advocate, that Steve does not infer. So there's something he cannot know.
That's true.
no comment. And the intuition of, I mean, it's basically a Creighton-Myers paradox. X is essentially the initial configuration of a Turing machine. Y, you can think of as whether the Turing machine halts. Halting style reasoning, diagonalization proofs over bits. It's really just a Creighton-Myers paradox. And that's all that you need to show this out. I can provide an example of it.
But you said that you were going to construct a theory that would allow oracles and such.
There's nothing in here that has any restriction. Actually, this is my very next slide. Not quite. Next one, or did I take that one out? Okay, that's two slides down.
Okay.
So what are some of the implications of this? And by the way, that is a really trivial result mathematically, but I want to first lay out the implications before I then cut the rug out from underneath me by showing how trivial it is. But this means a bunch of things. If we're talking about knowledge in the sense of prediction, means Laplace was wrong. I nowhere in there ruled out the possibility that we live in a classical, non-chaotic universe. Laplace's demon, supposedly, or a finite one even, Laplace's demon, that if you tell him enough right now, he can predict the future state of the universe. Any question?
Could you flash by a proof of that?
No, I'm going to get to an intuition of the proof in a couple of slides. The intuition is trivial, but first I want to actually, I'm cheating a little bit here, but if I first show you how trivial the proof is, you might go puff, puff. I want to first actually lay out some of the implications, and then in two slides I'll show you the proof. In essence, just geometrically outline it, rather than dot I's and cross T's. But so Laplace was wrong. Even if in the universe as he perceived it to be, there was always going to be a question that you could ask him to build a demon to answer that question about the future, and he could not reliably do that. The results of Fredkin, Chris Moore, Porel, Richards, the ones that I mentioned before, those impossibility results, which have to do with Turing machines and uncountable universes, they're far narrower in their applicability. If we talk about knowledge not concerning prediction but observation, then this means that for any observation apparatus, there is always some observation. In other words, there cannot be a general purpose observation apparatus. I can always come up with some observation that I would want it to make that it cannot guarantee to be correct. Note, I've got no probability distributions across this anymore, so that statement right now is not at all quantified. This holds even for a countable universe, even for a finite one. It holds even if the current laws of physics are wrong. To address Chris's question, it holds even if the device, if Steve, has super Turing capability, which we all suspect is the case. It holds even if the laws of nature are not written in predicate logic, or if Gödel's intuitionism is correct, or if there are no laws, all of these things, this result would still hold. So in that sense, it's both weaker than some of these impossibility results, but also more broadly ranging. And here is the triviality of how you can actually just prove that first one. There's Bob, who's been replaced, renamed Laplace, at some time T1. What he wants, and V, is going to be defined as all universes at some subsequent time T2, where he is giving his answer, and it's yes to the question he was asking at T1. So you sort of do things in a trivially obvious way. You forward evolve V into noon tomorrow, and you get some weirdo shape V prime that was just deterministic evolution according to laws of physics, and then just have the question that Laplace, Bob, is asking himself at T1 be, will the universe be outside of V prime at noon? And he cannot guarantee his answer is correct because it just, he's a Cretan liar against himself, essentially. And so that's actually a devil's advocate result. What it says is that you first give me a Laplace, and I can just run through the list of all possible things I might want him to know, and ha, I can find one that he can't guarantee being correct.
This was the proof?
I can dot the I's and cross the T's, but this is the intuition of it.
Say the trivial proof again.
Okay, so here's Laplace at T1. He's going to be asking a question. He's going to be giving his binary answer at T2. So here is T2. And at T2, I'm going to find the set V, which is all of those universes in that particular you were looking at, where he's giving the answer yes, being honest, and so on and so forth, whatever his T1 question was. I'm going to take that V and just forward evolve it to noon. This has got to do with prediction. And the question that I'm going to actually ask him at T1 is say, will the universe be outside of V prime at noon? So if he gives the answer yes, then the universe will actually be inside V prime at noon, so he's incorrect. And if he instead gives the answer no, he's outside of V, then in fact his answer would have been correct. The answer would have been yes.
So the question he's asking is sort of self-referential.
Exactly, without actually building self-reference into this. I'm being careful not to even assume that these devices can self-reference. I'm instead constructing the questions and so on to serve that same function. Kevin?
So this is all, and so you're able to do that because you're using the fact that any knowledge Laplace has to be physically coded. So it's part of the universe.
Yes.
And then that's where the self-referential.
Yes, you're asking a question, exactly so.
Can we say that in a more pedestrian way by saying something like, the reason why you can't predict the future is because by saying that you can't predict the future, implicitly assuming that the same laws that apply now will keep applying in the future, and you can never know that.
This could even be for laws that are constant across time.
What I'm saying is that you can never be certain that any law that is valid now or in the past will be valid in the future, and so you just can never predict the future. So the class will be wrong anyway.
I agree with your predicate, but this actually holds even if it's not true. Even if we somehow did know, what that word know might mean, even if we assumed that there was constancy in the laws of the universe, this would still be true. In essence, Laplace can't answer correctly with a yes or no the question, am I saying no? Mm-hmm. It's all that this really amounts to.
Right.
Lee?
It doesn't help you if V is empty.
One of the details, very good. Yeah. One of the details in here is I'm assuming that all of these functions are actually surjective. So I'm assuming that there is some universe in which Bob says yes and some in which he says no.
So what's confusing about the way you did it is you told us at point three what the question was at yes at time T1. So can you tell the story chronologically?
Oh, sure. At time T1, he asked himself, will the universe be outside of V prime at noon? What do I mean by V prime? V prime is defined as V of all forwards to noon. What does V mean? It means all possible states in the universe at T2 in the future in which I, Laplace, are actually saying the words yes, truthfully, honestly answering my question that I'm now posing to myself. So I'm setting up the question to be referring to itself, so to speak. Kevin?
So if you did have time in your worlds, right, so we were talking about adding extra structure, right, if you added time and you have this very strong necessary true belief definition of knowledge, and you added some realism to the interaction of the method with the world such that it can't see the future, then we could just let the example be all ravens are black, and no possible machine could do that either.
I'm not sure I'm following.
That's just sextus empiricus, right? I mean, if you had the extra detail in your model, that you can't see the future, you don't have a...
Oh, there's nothing in here. This holds just one for the past or the future.
No, I understand, but I'm saying you can get the result far more broadly if you add a little structure, keep the same definition of knowledge, and just implement the problem of induction for an arbitrary universal law, since this is a talk about laws, right?
Yeah.
So no law is going to be knowable by your criterion if you don't have a crystal ball.
Well,
a universal quantifier on you.
I very much want to talk with you about that afterwards, because the best way to actually add structure to this, there are many, many ways one could think to do it. I'm not perfectly clear on what's most fruitful. So
I mean, if you do that, it will just be formal learning theory, right? And then that's one of the basics.
Well, that's statistical inference. There's not even probability distributions yet. So,
formal learning theory doesn't have it. It's very similar to this. You just have the world as a sequence. You add the structure that the learner can only see a finite initial segment at a time, right? That allows you to implement the problem of induction. And then if you have any universal hypothesis, it's properly universal.
Oh, okay.
You can't know it under this necessary true belief, because you could always be fooled the next time, right?
There's a lot of structure that you put into that that's not here.
I understand, but it's just a way to get the stronger, more plausible. It wouldn't be just a self-referential thing, right? It would be every law is not knowable. You get the same.
We don't want that, I don't think. I mean, this is a much more general context.
Yeah.
You do it in Dutch.
Yeah, this has got nothing. This is not Hume.
Well, I mean, if you've got, if the concept, I mean, he does have one structure in there, that knowledge is necessary to belief. That's a very strong condition.
That's a definition of knowledge. That's what I'm saying. When we talk about all of this morning's discussions, were predicated on here are some things that I know. Lee?
If you weaken your set wide that things can be to an intuitionistic project where a possible response is neither yes nor no, but indeterminate, then you would not have a contradiction. So is the statement that if some form of logic is physically instantiated, consistently it has to be intuitionistic logic?
It could very well be that way, and that's a very interesting thought. The only way that I've explored this at all so far is to put probability distributions on it, and it turns out that this result and other ones are actually very fragile. So what you can actually show, I'll get to that, but very, very interesting. How should I be doing?
You should probably move on.
Move on? Okay.
How much more do you have?
I'm probably about halfway through. I'll sprint.
You got 5 minutes to do that.
Okay, interesting 5 minutes. Okay.
Well, let's look, apportion it the way you want. Take the questions you want or just say, okay, no, so I want to plow ahead. But
what he said.
The ultimate limit will be 10 till 2.
Oh, I won't be anywhere close to that, but okay. So anyway, this result is a devil's advocate worst case result. To give me a plus, I can, with malice aforethought, construct something that this poor fellow can't get. But it's the same kind of criticism that's been leveled against Gödel's incompleteness theorem. Well, there's something out there that'll nuke us, but so what? You don't have to worry about it. So one can, much more broadly, what you're going to be interested in is, let's say, I've got a couple of devices, and they are themselves arbitrary. I'm not going to design one to thwart the other. And now I'm going to ask questions about whether they can know one another's conclusion. So this is Philip and Kevin. They are both wanting to, they are both wanting to know one another's answer by observation, by prediction, or whatnot. Now, it turns out that there's no difficulty with that. I'm not doing any kind of a devil's advocate thing, so it's quite possible that Chris and Philip can actually know one another's answer. But that can actually only happen if one of the two controls the other one. So to make that more precise, exactly so. So to make that more precise, I'm going to define Philip and Chris to be distinguishable if for any one of the kinds of questions so each of them individually has a set of questions they could be asking. And I'm going to be saying that for any actual pair of questions in that Cartesian product, there's some world line in which that pair is being posed to themselves by both of them. So in other words, the question that Chris is asking himself does not make it impossible for Philip to be asking any arbitrary one of his questions. In that sense, I can distinguish their laptops. The way that Philip sets up his laptop, he can't set up with a special program that would force it, so that there's a restriction on what programs Chris can set up. That's what I'm going to find to be distinguishable. Once I add in that structure, then it doesn't matter what these devices are, no devil's advocate. It turns out that one of you guys is wrong. And more broadly, I'm just going to be very, very cute. What it means is that, well, let's say we have a whole bunch of inference devices, all the people in this room trying to know one another's answers to various questions. It turns out that there may or may not be one of you who, it's most likely Steve, one of you who can actually infer and know what everybody else is concluding. There might or might not be one, but there can be no more than one. There can be, potentially, there's one of you that can control everybody else, but there can't be more than one of you. There can only be one. And moreover, when you really dig into it, because this goes across time, if there is one of you that can control everything, you can actually only do it at one instance. So intelligent design or some such silly thing. And there's other kinds of ways that you can play around with the notion of distinguishability to see whether you're going to have transitive ifity obeyed and so on and so forth. So in the sense of sprinting, here is how you sort of prove that. This is no longer, I should perhaps rewrite this as Chris and Philip, but for now it's Bob and Alice. And the way that you play the game is that you define V, which is all the time to T2 histories where Bob is answering yes, but the analogous set for Alice is also where she's saying yes. You then evolve V to V prime, W to W prime, and here are the questions that we are asking them. You ask Bob, will the universe be in W prime? But Alice, you ask a different one, you say, will it be outside of V prime? And when you just ricochet back through the logical implications, you see that's impossible for both Bob and Alice to be giving the correct answer. Getting a little bit back towards classical epistemology, it turns out that this actually does obey at least many of the properties of Boolean algebra. I haven't actually exhaustively gone through them all yet. So, in other words, this is sort of saying that this definition of knowledge matches up with the conventional kinds of definitions of knowledge that people have been exploring for, I don't know, a century now or so. So, for example, you can prove that any device, any inference device, it may know A, it may know not A, but it's impossible for it to actually know both. Another issue, it turns out that this is something that's a conundrum that sometimes arises in epistemology. Let's say that we were so unfortunate as to define knowledge to say that if Chris knows A, and also Chris knows the implication A implies B, then Chris knows B. We have a definition of knowledge in which that's true, and some analogous properties, then we run into a problem, because just by knowing the axioms of arithmetic, this would then mean that Chris knows all truths that can be derived from those axioms. This is something that you might object to as a definition of knowledge. It doesn't actually occur here. If Chris knows A, and he knows the event that A implies B, then B is necessarily true, but Chris may not know that. And you also get things like transitivity of the same as in Boolean algebra. If Chris knows that A implies B, and he knows that B implies C, in this case, he actually knows that A implies C. And Chris knows that he knows, and things like that. And so I'll very, very briefly, I guess, just touch on what happens if you throw on a probability distribution and end it there, I guess. There's a bunch of things, as Lee emphasized, the set U is completely unstructured. There's no notion of distance, so there's certainly no way that something like Planck's constant could even go into this. No notion of how close things are, and there's no kind of a metric structure, and there's no probability distribution. What happens if we put a probability distribution over things? Well, the question then becomes, how do you weaken the notion of inference to take into account probability distributions? There are probably a bunch of different ways that you could do it, but here is one. You can't actually use mutual information, saying that there's strong mutual information between a device and what it wants to infer, because mutual information, being based on Shannon information theory, it's syntactic, it's not semantic, and everything here is very, very carefully constructed to be semantic. The answer yes is a different thing from the answer no. So what you can actually do is you can define the covariance accuracy of a particular device trying to know the answer to some question, to know the state of the sky tomorrow, as being the sum over all questions you might ask of the best actual covariance between its answer and the truth. So that's sort of the one way that you might be able to define what it means to be able to infer something to a certain probabilistic degree, in terms of the simple mind notions of a covariance. And there's a lower bound on it that actually depends upon the size of the space of questions that you're asking. But here is the brittleness that I alluded to before. The second Laplace impossibility theorem, the monotheism one, says that it's impossible for Chris and Philip, if they are distinguishable, to actually guaranteed infer one another. However, if we look at their covariance accuracies, then there is always going to be some probability distribution in which their covariance accuracies in terms of inferring one another is arbitrarily close to one. Whether the universe does actually obey that probability distribution or not is a different issue, but you can get very, very close. On the other hand, even though that impossibility theorem is barely true, there are some related results that appear to be quite strong. What I'm doing here, this is a very, very impoverished kind of a situation, a very, very toy example. I'm saying that the questions that the two devices can ask each other, that Chris and Philip, there are only two possible things they can ask each other. And then I'm just right here just defining some of the other constants. Here is some question that I'm asking. And then if these constants turn out to be a certain way, then it turns out that independent of the underlying probability distributions, the product of the covariance accuracy of Chris and that of Philip is bounded above by 1/4. Now, again, because there's no kind of a metric in here, no kind of a notion of any kind of a scale, you would not expect to see an H or anything like that on the right-hand side. But I'll leave that simply saying that I find this intriguing. And end it there.
Kevin was interested in the question of whether this makes the laws of nature unknowable. And I'm wondering about...
I did not know that would happen.
I don't know how to bring it back.
Oh, I think...
It's like a game still on.
I thought I was turning on the lights.
Thanks.
Oh, there we go.
But it seems to me that the way you set things up might have the opposite problem, that is it makes it too easy to know what the laws of nature are. So, because it seems to me that I could sort of trivially specify a device for knowing laws of nature. Like this is a specified device, I got to say what the X is and say what the Y is, right? And then show that.
If you define a device, you specify those functions, X and Y. Yes.
Right, okay. So suppose something is a law of nature, so call it L. And now, I'm not sure how to specify X. Make X whatever it has to be for my device to ask the question or consider the question. Is L a law?
Yes, in fact, one of the things that many things I sped through way back here, it turns out, I think, for anything I might want to know, for any particular function, I can always construct a device that does know it, if that's where you're going. So if this is a law of nature, I can always construct a device. I can always choose an X and a Y function.
Right, but it seems to me that this makes things too easy. To do it. And here's what I mean, just make your device such that it asks, is L a law? And then make Y be the constant function that always
passes. Oh, but remember, in response to Lee's question, I'm requiring that you be able to give any answer. But more generally, this is very weak. I do think that true richness would come out of adding extra properties that, there's many things that are not in here that's intuitive. Like, for example, to know the answer to a question, I know what question I'm even asking. There's no notion that Bob even knows that. There's a lot that's not in this definition of knowledge that I think could quite reasonably be put in. Anyway. Yes?
This is just a question of clarification. I didn't understand your comment about closure under known implication. So when you said that you get kind of a Boolean algebra structure...
Actually, I haven't gone through all the way to get a Boolean algebra. I've just gone through that some of the properties.
My initial thought was this just follows from the topology of subsets of the space of possible worlds.
This is ultimately set theory and playing games like that. But to do this, you've got to worry about these particular kind of sets. I can always find an X such that... and that there is a binary valued y. So that is what you're driving.
But when you're putting them together for the negation, conjunction, the question about the claim here is more specific because I don't actually know what you mean to say truths of mathematics. I mean, it doesn't seem like your account applies to that.
This is a physical fact. This is not mathematical fact.
Right.
So, an extremely intriguing thing, because this is so broad, would be to say, let's stop thinking of U's as being world lines. Let's think of U's as being statements in a predicate logic. What does this say about being able to know things about math? I have no idea where that might go.
Okay, I just thought that, so if you think of, how do you think of then the knows events, the implication, how do you think of that? Because it wasn't clear to me why you said that it doesn't follow that you know that B.
I have to go through I can construct a scenario in which you know A. The event A implies B. That's defined just like in propositional logic that that is basically going to be true unless if A is false, then you can't have the case that B is true. So that's going to define events. Then A is an event, you crank the handle on what it means to know. I can actually construct a situation in which an X and a Y, and events A, and so on, where you know A, you know this, but you don't know B. I can actually construct that.
Godel-like proof. So it seems to me what you're saying there is effectively, Bob can't know the truth of a statement like this statement is false, because you get a paradox.
In a certain sense, that's all it amounts to.
I don't know this.
But
Godel's theorem is really about a distinction between provability and truth.
Yes, and there's nothing in here about provability. Yeah. This is not Godel's theorem. It's in many ways, I would say, orders of magnitude less profound in a certain sense. And that relied on a devil's advocate. I can construct a function such that you are going to be wrong, and in essence, it's just a Cretan life, as I emphasize. Here, though, it's not a devil's advocate. This is for any two Bob and Alice. And what turns out to be crucial is that Bob and Alice are actually distinguishable. If I allow it to be the case that how Bob is, the question he asks, that's the question that Alice asks.
I wasn't actually asking about the Alice-Bob case, but the earlier case where there was just...
Yeah, that one is the one that's...
Let me challenge you. So this strikes me as less interesting than Godel's theorem.
I agree.
It's not possible to know the truth of statements like, this statement is false. I would say, it doesn't feel like a restriction on what I can know about the world. it doesn't seem to me to have the same sort of content that Godel's theorem does.
It's a different kind of a beast. Godel's theorem has to do with mathematical truths, and this has to do with physical ones. Remember, I was even explicitly saying I want to first show you the implications before giving the triviality of the proof. It means just things like Laplace was wrong, and in some sense, it's almost like, that's a cheap shot. I completely agree with that. This is one that I think has a little bit more depth to it. If for no other reason, because it actually illustrates the crucial importance of having the two different devices be distinguishable, that you don't actually get an impossibility if it is the case that the one partially controls the other, that you do need to have them be distinguishable. That is one that I think at least reveals some things that aren't quite so single-sentencely trivial. Kevin?
Maybe this is a more sympathetic way to the last point. I was playing around with learning theoretic models for knowledge operators, and I ran into these kind of monsters too, right? So I think one of the ways you can look at this is if you're trying to work up a more realistic semantics for epistemic modal logic, you're going to have to cut out these kind of troublesome cases to get interesting laws of the logic. And so that really is a kind of problem with modal epistemic logic when you have a realistic semantics for it. You don't get some nice clean axioms unless you guard them against cases like this.
I would say that most people that you ask on the street, when they say that they know something, and you say, okay, does that mean that I can ask you, do you know X, and you can answer a binary question for any such thing? They will say yes. So I think this accords certainly with the intuition behind what it meant to know certain data and events in all this morning's talks. And it does give structure out of it, like this one concerning the product of covariance accuracy, that I don't think in any sense that this rules it out. I think instead it reveals, I don't think, for example, that the Hulting theorem rules out Turing machines as a model of computation. I don't think that Godel's...
I think we're at cross. I was making a friendly comment.
Ben, more power to you. Ben, elaborate, sir.
These kind of things are going to arise when you...
They're unavoidable.
Modal logic, and they're going to get in the way of natural things you'd like to get. Like, I was fishing for a naturalistically plausible version of a KK thesis. Right? You're not going to get... I don't believe that we always know what we know, right? Because there are a lot of reasons why you don't know what you know unless you take that to be a commitment. So, there's this phony talk, it's really a commitment, or you're more, you're socially responsible to do that, blah, blah. No, let's just do knowledge. That's what we started out doing. But then KK is going to, these things are going to be a wrench in the jaws of KK, right? Because you're not going to, you can construct similar kind of nasty, self-referential things against that, and you just have to be aware of it. So I'm saying this is real stuff if your interest is a general. Self-applicability is what's cool about modal semantics, right? And these things are going to arise, so I think this is a real issue.
And it's very much in the spirit of this morning's talks and that's just drilling down on things. And so, for example, when Philip was talking about having many, many instances paired the exact same way or the exact same system, you have to know that that these have all been paired the same way. And I'm just pointing out that the dotted line of what kinds of things we can consider in a mathematical way can actually get perilously close to inside of our own noggins.
I've thought about things like the same connection and thinking about future things that you'll come to believe. And I actually think it might faithfully reproduce features of our own kind of epistemic attitudes. In particular, it's related to the reason that you can't take a purely epistemic attitude to the result of your own deliberation because of things like building arguments. Tell me at any moment to predict the outcome of a deliberative process. Give me that knowledge and I can build it.
Elaborate?
Tell me now to predict the outcome. Tell me what I'll come to believe about what I will do at time t. If I claim to know at any time before that what I will do, I can build craft.
You mean contradict it.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, that's essentially this first, more trivial one. Yeah.
So, but that's related to the reason that we can't take a kind of purely epistemic attitude towards the outcome of our own deliberative processes, where you think of deliberation as beliefs about what we will come to decide to do at time t.
Perhaps about our own deliberative processes, but when you go through and actually construct the math here, X and Y are completely abstract objects. They're just functions over the space. There's nothing in here that's actually saying that in any particular sense they have to do with the same concrete physical individual. They are just functions over all of reality. This could be the entire universe's thinking about itself.
It's crucial, though, that the, sort of the domain over which you're assigning probabilities, or the domain over which you're sort of forming beliefs, includes your own actions. So there are fixed points. And you know that it does. And you're being asked now to form beliefs about the values of those propositions.
Okay, well, fixed points implies dynamics across this.
That your beliefs about those things will itself be included among the domain to which you're assigning values or probabilities.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there are these kind of...
So what I'm saying is that is what opens up the space for deliberation.
It opens up the space for deliberation.
Okay. Suppose you've got a domain over which you're assigning either, we'll just stick to truth values instead of probabilities. Okay. And now you come to notice that among that domain, there are these sort of reflexive propositions. Now you notice, that's odd. I can't simply regard that as a proposition that's either true or false, to which I can now assign.
Okay, but here's a thing. There's nothing in this that actually says that the question that I pose to Bob has to be the one that he correctly answers. This all will work fine if Bob is mistaken in what question he thinks he's asking. All of this requires is that there's some way that I can configure Bob's brain. I motivated it by saying that let's assume that Bob's going to set up his brain a certain way. But actually, the universal quantifier that Kevin was referring to, it just says that there's some way of setting up Bob's brain, maybe making him completely hallucinatory, so that he actually thinks that he's answering a question different from the one I'm posing, and just by luck, I still give him credit. This is extremely weak. He gets credit just for luck. The actual question in his head could even have the right answer, and this is saying that he still can't do it, as well as him getting it by luck and things like this. So none of that's being put in there.
Then
you get the more structure, which is, as I tried to indicate before, I think there's much more, as you add more structure, much more richer things come, just like in the Chomsky hierarchy.
Well, so what I'm suggesting then is in that situation, when he does have the knowledge, then you do open up interesting features that reproduce facts about our own epistemic attitudes towards sort of our own future delivery processes and own beliefs about our own future. Insofar as we think that our beliefs about our own future depend on what we know, what we will come to believe about what we will do.
Well, you have many woolly words, not only monotheism and that kind of cutesy stuff, but also even notions of free will. To say that, for example, Philip and Chris are distinguishable, one could argue that that is Well, my personal view is that free will is an unmeaningful thing. But one could say that it's tried to formalize it as something like Philip and Chris are distinguishable, that Chris, by configuring himself up, however he cannot configure himself in a particular way, his brain cannot be in a particular state that restricts what makes it impossible for Phillips to be in some particular state, that in a certain sense allows for freedom.
Well, it can be made precise in the sense, in the following, so relatively deflation, I guess I'm saying. My beliefs about what I will do, and if you can think of what I will do, meaning how my body will move, and imagine that I believe that how my body moves depends at least in part on a kind of willful event that says my arm shall raise or my leg. And that I have to treat that willful event as a free variable from any epistemic perspective before that.
Are you familiar with Ben Leibitz's work, where there's a lot of work in neurobiology in which it's very, very clearly demonstrated that things like deciding to raise your arm, the decision is made before you're actually conscious of it.
No, that's okay. Yeah, I think it's also a certain state.
Okay.
But I agree that needs to be addressed.
Okay. We can take one more question. Or we can go to coffee. Thanks, Steve. The discussion of the questions is going to be